that he was, and we hugged it out for a while. I let him romp around while I kept getting things ready. I was almost all packed when Attila tugged my shirt and clicked his teeth repeatedly. I knew what he wanted. We finally kissed and made up. Natalie would have puked. "I have to go away for a few days now," I said after I put him back into his cage. "It won't be easy, but you're going to be fine. Mrs. Abreu will look in on you early tomorrow, and so will Natalie. You remember Natalie?"
"You be good to her, hear me?
I know you understand me." Attila made a couple whoops of complaint.
"I know, I know. It can't be helped. I'm gonna miss you too."
Chapter 11. It was early summer. The morning light illuminated the crushed Marlboro boxes and Happy Meal cups in the roadside weeds. Terrific. I'd just started my amazing journey and I was already lost in the wilds of Queens. Staring out from the back of my sticky JFK-bound taxi, I cursed as we slowed to a dead stop. Again. We lurched forward a bit and then stopped again. The cabbie bashed the horn and spat out a string of curses, went back to talking to somebody on his headset. Sounded like he was talking business. He was very dark and matchstick skinny, a lot of red in his eyes. Above the dash, I could see that the LIE had become a frozen, curving conveyor belt of red brake lights. It was so bad, even the jackasses on the shoulder trying to cut people off were jammed to a halt. Surrounded by my bulky camera case, laptop, and carry-on, I checked the time on my iPhone for the 500th time. It was looking like making my 9:05 a.m. flight to Africa was going to need divine intervention in order to happen. I also noticed an email from Natalie and made the mistake of opening it. "You don't have to do this," I sighed. Maybe my girlfriend was right. Maybe this was nuts. Wouldn't it make more sense to head out to the Hamptons with her instead? Get some sand in my shoes, eat some oysters. I could certainly use a Long Island iced tea or 10, not to mention a tan. Couldn't this trip wait? No. I knew full well it couldn't. I was committed to this thing, far past the point of no return. Hamptons or no Hamptons, HAC was happening. Right here, right now, right friggin' everywhere. I could feel it in my pores. I went through my travel kit again. I sorted through my passport, my insurance, my federally mandated less-than-3-ounce travel toiletries, my skivvies, t-shirts, and shorts, my red wool hat. Then I scooped up my anti-malarial doxycycline pills that had spilled over my folded-up poncho until everything was wired tight. To hell with the naysayers. I was good to go. Botswana or bust. The last thing to do was print out my e-ticket when I got to the airport. If I ever got there. When we finally started moving, I took out a map of Africa. I was a 40-60 mix of nervous-excited. Just the sheer size of Africa. 3 times as big as Europe. I had learned so much about the continent during my first trip when I was still in grad school. But this was different. This was no field trip. The cabbie quit nattering into his Bluetooth and turned to me.
"Which terminal, sir?"
The airport was finally beginning to crawl into sight. "I'm not sure," I said. "My flight's on South African Airways."
"You are going to Africa? South Africa?"
asked the cabbie. I'd been preoccupied. Now I noticed the guy looked and sounded African himself. His voice had that melodic lilt of African English. Nigerian, maybe. "Botswana," I said.
"You go from New York to Botswana? No. For real?"
the cabbie said, his red eyes wide in the rear view. He seemed even more skeptical than my girlfriend. I was getting nothing but unbridled support and good omens from all corners tonight. "That's the idea," I said, as we pulled in front of a bustling terminal.
"Well, I hope it's a business trip," he said,
as he printed my receipt from the meter.
"You make damn sure a business trip, man. You know what I mean?"
I did know what he meant, unfortunately. He was referring to Botswana's AIDS epidemic, the second worst in the world. 1 out of every 4 adults in the country was supposed to have the dreaded sexually transmitted disease. I wasn't too worried about it. Between my long trip and dealing head-on with a frightening global epidemic,
I didn't think I'd have much time to squeeze in any hot, wild, condomless third-world sex. Besides, I had a girlfriend.
Don't worry, I told the cabbie as I opened the door. I won't have any fun at all.
Chapter 12.
About 4 hours later, I woke up 30,000 feet above the Atlantic, blinking in the low, lonely roar of the 747's cabin. I raised my seat and looked out the window beside me. Through spaces in the milky floor of dim clouds, I could see the silver squiggles of the surf on the ocean far below. I definitely wasn't in Kansas anymore, or Queens, thank God. I yawned, unlocked and lowered my seatback tray, and worried my laptop out of my carry-on bag. I was going to write some emails, but instead I found myself clicking open the file for the HAC PowerPoint presentation I'd shown in Paris. It began with a photograph of a primitive painting from the famous Lascaux Caves in France that clearly showed a guy being killed by a bison. Next was Rubens' Chained Prometheus. In the painting, the torment in the upside-down Titan's face is pretty damn visceral as an eagle tears into his, well, viscera. The Rubens was followed quickly by Nicolas Poisson's haunting Renaissance painting, The Plague at Ashdod, depicting a scene in which God has sent a plague of disease and mice onto the Philistines for disobeying him. Next came stranger, darker, lesser-known images. I felt my pulse skip a little when an ancient sculpture of a reclining jaguar appeared. It was found in an Aztec temple, along with an apocalyptic prophecy of animals devouring all humanity. The jaguar was followed by an eerie illustration from the Toggenburg Bible. It shows a man and a woman dying of bubonic plague. There's something about its bright, static flatness, a characteristic of medieval art, that makes it particularly disturbing. The naked figures lie stiffly in bed like paper dolls, their pale bodies polka-dotted with protruding buboes. The Black Death, which killed 40% of the known world's population, had been started by marmots and carried throughout Europe by rats. I looked out the window again. As I stared at the clouds thousands of feet below me, and the ocean below that, I had a strange sensation. It was a sinking, chilling feeling. For a moment, hurtling 600 miles an hour toward Africa, I felt suddenly very tiny and very alone. I wasn't religious, but as I sat there, I started wondering about the inexplicable nature of these things. It was as though I could actually feel the apocalyptic shift that was occurring. I thought of horses, birds, snakes. I thought of the curse God puts on the snake in Genesis. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. The wrath of God. Or maybe it was just my jet lag, I thought, rubbing the gunk out of my eyes. There was no doubt that I'd become obsessed with HAC. I thought about all the sleepless nights, the quitting school, and now I was actually on a plane to Africa. Maybe I would finally find the answers I was looking for. Or maybe I was delusional. I was beginning to doubt my own sanity. I glanced down at my laptop and saw that I had another email from Natalie. This one was a real picker-upper. Oz, I know this is probably a bad time to say this. Oh boy, I knew what was coming. I almost quit reading then and there. The same way I looked at my bank statements in those days, just flicked my eyes over it, knowing I don't want to see it. Anyway, I read the rest quickly. But I've been thinking about everything, and I guess, bottom line, I just can't do all this anymore, at least not now. I just got back my immunology midterm. I flunked it. I'll be lucky if I get a C now. It's not just that. I'm distracted, and I have to concentrate on school and my career. I know I shouldn't email all this. We'll talk when you get back. And you need to get someone else to check on Attila. I'm too swamped. Okay, then, I thought. Whoopee! I'm back on the market. I considered replying to her email, but then decided just to ignore it. Leave things alone. I couldn't turn back now. Natalie knew that. And I knew Natalie's priority was to become a doctor. She'd always been clear about that. Maybe we did need a break. I'd just have to call the other woman in my life. I left a message for Mrs. Abreu on her machine, begging her to feed Attila for me until I came back. She wouldn't let me down. I closed my laptop and stretched. I had 12 hours to go before I reached Johannesburg for my stopover. I reached into my laptop bag for my iPod, put in my earbuds, cranked some Black Sabbath, and headed down the aisle of the speeding plane in search of the stewardess and some Red Bull. Book 2. Into Africa. Chapter 13. My first glimpse of Africa, 12 hours later, was actually sort of a letdown. Johannesburg, beyond the massive windows of the airport, was just a bunch of nondescript buildings. Could have been Cleveland. An hour later, when we took off northbound for Botswana, my mood lifted considerably. The green and tan expanse of seemingly endless landscape looked the way the little kid in me wanted Africa to look. Hot, wild, secluded. As we were beginning our final descent into Mon, I saw there were some modern buildings, but most of the structures were cinder block and tin. Coming down the steps onto the tarmac, I saw that, beyond the flimsy chain-link fence along the airport's perimeter, there were donkeys everywhere. There were also rondavels, the traditional African thatch-roofed huts built of stone and cow dung. The feel of the place, the heat, the sweetish smell of manure and diesel, even the sharp, blinding yellow light, was pleasantly strange. After I made it through customs, Abraham Bendix took off his tattered straw hat and greeted me with a bear hug inside the rundown terminal. Abraham was a boiler tank of a man, broad-shouldered and blocky. The 50-ish, weather-beaten man reminded me of a Sunbelt college football coach. His face was as hard and creased as an old work glove, with a mustache fading into the scruff on his cheeks. A shag carpet of chest hair burst from the unbuttoned neck of his sweat-dampened linen shirt. Some faded blue tattoos on the furry wine barrels he called his arms were reminders of his Navy days. It was good to see his loopy, gap-toothed smile. The last time I'd seen him was in Paris. We'd sat at the hotel bar and gotten drunk as swine after I'd been booed off the convention stage. He seemed heavier than I remembered him in Paris. He also seemed noticeably older and a little slower on his feet. I wondered if he was ill.
"Thank you for coming, my friend. But I have bad news," he said as I scooped up my bags from the pile of luggage beside the plane.
I liked Abraham, but took him with a grain of salt. Like a lot of Afrikaners, he was crude as oil and casually racist in a way that can make a white American dude a touch uncomfortable. Still, there was something almost grandfatherly about him, something Papa Bear.
"Unfortunately, a problem has arisen," he said. "A family thing. Is it possible for you to wait a day before I can take you up to the village near Zimbabwe?"
"Of course. What's up, Abe? Can I help?" I said.
"No, no. It is a family thing," he said.
Abe had a warm, brassy honk of a voice, like a muted trumpet.
"My little brother Philip, the pacifist, is the manager at a game-spotting lodge over in the bush near the Namibian border. I take rich American tourists out to kill animals, but he takes them out just to look at them, take pictures. Lions, actually. 2 huge prides of them that eat the Cape Buffalo up there in the Okavango Delta."
"What's the problem?"
"Don't know, man. His lodge has been out of radio contact for over 24 hours, and me mom is worried. It is probably nothing, but with all the craziness been going on, I need to make sure the wanker is okay."
"So, let's head out," I said. "You said the lodge has lions, right? Lions are what I just came 8,000 miles to see." My enthusiasm seemed to brighten Abe's spirit.
"Right, man," he said, slapping my shoulder.
It hurt a little.
"I knew you were a friend, Oz. I tried to get my trekkers to come with me, but the superstitious boogies are still completely spooked by the slaughtered village we came across. The pagan bastard said they wanted nothing to do with the lions until, quote, the spirits are calmer, unquote."
Uncalm spirits. Lions. I thought about my sinking feeling on the plane, the feeling of God's wrath in the air. Then I dismissed it. I wadded up my uneasiness and tossed it over my shoulder. "Which way to Okavango?" I said, hefting my camera case. Chapter 14. Instead of heading out of the airport, Abe and I walked south inside the terminal and made a right into a narrow, dingy corridor.
What are we doing? I thought we were going to your brother's lodge, I said.
Right, man, we are. In the Northern Delta, there are no roads, only airstrips, Abe explained.
Walking, he dug a tin of chewing tobacco out of one of the pockets of his khaki utility vest, scooped some of it into his fingers, and put a wad under his lip.
We need to rent a plane.
Rent a plane? I said. I hope you know how to fly one, because I only know how to jump out of them.
That skill might come in handy, Abe said.
His jaw was working, moistening the chaw. He winked.
I have a license, but I have not flown in some time.
We went through a door and walked right back out onto the tarmac beside the plane I just exited. I noticed they were a little more lax with security here on the Dark Continent. No one even asked me to take off my shoes. We turned a corner into a hangar. A half-black, half-Asian man in a greasy fedora sat behind a desk eating some kind of barbecued meat with his fingers. Another African, who looked like a soldier or policeman, judging by his soiled gray uniform and gray beret, sat next to him and wore a flat black AK-47 over his shoulder. They both had their feet up and were watching a movie on a portable DVD player. I peeked over the policeman's shoulder. It was Happy Gilmore, the Adam Sandler movie. They weren't laughing. Granted, it wasn't very funny, but they didn't seem to get that it was a comedy. Abe spent about 10 minutes bellowing like a bull at the two of them in a language I soon learned was Setswana. In the end, Abraham, his face sweaty, red, and puffy with heat, fished around in the pouches of his utility vest and handed the guy at the desk a folded wad of bills. The man thumbed through them with hands that were still sticky from the meat he'd been eating, seemed satisfied, and directed us outside with a mafia tough's chin jerk that he'd probably learned from American movies. We walked outside and down a lane between two rows of small bush planes. Abe threw open the door of a rust-flaked red-and-white Piper Super Cub that had cartoonishly oversized Tundra tires and squeezed my bags behind the seats.
"Wait here, man," he said. "I'll be right back."
Abe went back into the hangar. When he returned a moment later, he was coming from the other end of the airport, riding in a battered Range Rover. Two dogs, sleek red-brown Rhodesian Ridgebacks, tumbled out when he opened his door. They hopped into the plane as though they'd done so plenty of times before. Then Abe heaved two large gun cases from the truck and packed them into the plane as well. He caught me looking at the guns.
"Better to have and not need than need and not have, right, man?"
he said, giving my cheek an avuncular pinch. Soon, my ears were nestled in squishy radio headphones, and we were taxiing onto the runway. On the other side of the airport's dusty service road, I spotted a fenced field that had stones and strange striped tents in it.
"What's that, Abe?"
I shouted over the gathering roar of the propeller chop, pointing.
"That's a graveyard,"
Abe shouted back. He opened the plane's throttle, and we began bouncing down the tarmac.
"So many dead from AIDS around here, they cannot dig fast enough. So they pile the coffins under tents. What's the American joke about cemeteries?"
"People are dying to get in," I offered.
"Right, man. That's the one."
Abe gave me a sardonic smile. His teeth were jumbly crooked and tobacco-stained. He pulled back the throttle, and our tiny plane left terra firma.
"Welcome to Africa, man."
Chapter 15.
Even with my jet lag, the claustrophobic confinement of the plane, and a dog panting fragrantly in each ear, that 30-minute plane ride was the most exhilarating of my life. Flying over the Okavango Delta was like going back in time. I half expected to see dinosaurs walking around below us. There wasn't a single building, not a house, or even a rondavel on the endless brown plain rippling along beneath us. I watched the shadow of the aircraft glide over white islands dotted between clear blue ribbons of water. On them were palm trees and giant lumps of earth that Abe told me were termite mounds. Now that it was July, one of the winter months, Abe explained, the Delta dried up and swelled to 3 times its normal size, attracting one of the greatest concentrations of wildlife on the planet. We flew over hippos, hyenas, a herd of massive Cape buffalo, horned and black, which Abe told me were considered by some professional hunters to be more dangerous than lions. There were river birds, seemingly in the millions, scattering from the dry marshes at the sound of our plane. The first humans we saw were a couple of African fishermen in a hand-cut dugout. Who needs the Discovery Channel, I thought.
This is it, Abe said a few minutes later, his voice crackling over my headphones.
We lowered our speed and altitude as we banked down towards some thatched roofs beside the faint white scar of an airstrip. I was expecting the landing to be as bumpy as the takeoff, so I was surprised when Abe laid the Piper down as smooth as silk. I pulled off my headphones, and in the wake of the noise, the silence was almost ghostly. My ears rang a bit.
That is funny, Abe said as we climbed out of the plane and into the heat. Not funny, ha-ha.
What? I said.
The stiff. When they see a plane landing, they are usually waiting here, clapping, singing their silly folk songs and holding a stiff drink and a hot towel. I do not see or hear anything. Do you? Not even any animals.
He was right. The only sound was the thrumming drone of insects under the glaring sky. The thatch-roofed buildings in the distance, which we could see at the end of a dusty path lined with brittle brown reeds and papyrus, all seemed empty, deserted. A silvery band of light shimmered on the horizon, vague, shaking with heat. Abe whistled, and the two sleek red dogs broke into a trot, scouting ahead, heads scanning, their sense of smell going into overdrive. The camp we followed them into was as bustling as a graveyard. We searched all six platform tents, along with the dining area. We found clothes, luggage, safari gear, tourist stuff, pith helmets and khaki utility vests, open portmanteaus spewing socks and underwear onto unmade beds, but no tourists and no staff. There was what looked like a shipping container, a giant red box of corrugated metal, behind the kitchen. Alongside it, we found a Land Rover with two extra rows of raised seats to accommodate wildlife watchers. Abe half coughed and half cursed in a language I didn't recognize. He spat a jet of shit-brown tobacco juice into the grass and wiped his mouth with his shirt.
Two of the trucks are missing. Besides the guides, there are another half dozen maids and cooks. This is very strange, Oz. Where the devil is everyone? Where is my little brother? I have a bad feeling.
Abe put his fingers to his lips and pierced the air with a whistle. And the dogs came running. He hopped into the Rover, found the keys, and started the engine. After we drove back to the plane and retrieved his rifles, we drove north from the camp over a badly rutted car path. Pebbles popped and crunched under the tires, and the car rattled and shuddered over the washboard-like waves in the road. When the car path petered out, we hit an even bumpier field of tall, dry grass. Around a stand of ebony trees, some baby hyenas were wading in the shallow river water, fat gloves of reeking mud on their paws. I couldn't help but gawk as though I were on safari, but if Abe noticed them or the family of giraffes drinking in the shallows 100 feet south of them downriver, he didn't say anything. We were steering around a stand of fig trees when we finally saw people. A group of Africans stood milling around by a dock at the river's edge. It was two men and a pudgy boy, all in chef's whites, and they were preparing to get into some dugouts. Abe pulled hard on the wheel, piloted the Rover over to the men, and brought it to a jerky stop. He shouted something quick at them in Setswana. The men yelled something back. They seemed to be arguing. The conversation took a few minutes. At the end of it, the three kitchen workers reluctantly got out of the canoe and climbed into the back of the car. I turned around and looked at them. Their faces were stolid and blank, hard to read. They didn't acknowledge me. "What's the story?" I said to Abe as we pulled away. Abe tucked another pinch of tobacco into his cheek.
"It's worse than I thought, men. Two groups went out day before yesterday, 20 people, including my brother. Haven't heard from them since. Not only that, they said lions were actually in the camp last night, roaming around like stray kittens, picking at scraps. These bozos back there hid themselves in the shipping container. When they woke up, the radio transmitter had been broken, smashed somehow. Just now, they were going to try to go downstream to get help.
Why were you arguing? Abe took off his straw hat and wiped sweat off his sunburned brow. Abe perspired like a leaky faucet.
I told them to come help us find the tourists and guides, but like my trekkers, they're terrified. They said something is wrong with the lions. The same superstitious boogie shit. The gods are angry. There's black magic about. Ooga booga booga.
Behind us, the cook started singing some sort of chant.
Ah, here they go, Abe said, jerking a thumb over his shoulder at them. Ooh-ee-ooh-ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang.
Abe stomped the brake and brought the rover to a sudden stop. He hopped out, went into his bag in the back, and took out one of the hunting rifles. It was a Winchester Model 70, bored for a massive .458 cartridge. He loaded a magazine with the huge brass shells and slapped it home with a clack. He climbed up into the back, maneuvering around the men, bags, and dogs, and strapped it into the truck's gun rack.
You bozos want black magic? I'll show you some black magic,
he called back at them as he revved the engine and threw the truck into gear.
Chapter 16.
A little less than a mile northeast of the safari camp's river dock, two massive male lions lounge on the highest rocks in their pride area. They lie on their stomachs, still as golden rugs, panting, catching the breeze. Their impassive amber eyes lazily scan the horizon. Like dogs, but unlike humans, lions are unable to sweat through their skin. Their only effective means of thermoregulation is panting. The heavy breathing they are doing now, though, isn't from the heat, or even from exertion. It is from eating. Beneath them, scattered throughout the thorny scrub of the forest glen, swarms of fat, shiny flies hover above the meat that lies rotting under the sun's steady blaze. They tickle across the bones, collectively making a wavy droning noise like a cello holding a note in sustained vibrato. Human bodies, or rather human body parts, are strewn in the bloody grass. Rib cages and hip bones shine white as aspirin under the blinding sun. The rest of the pride is arranged in a large, loose circle around the bones. Vultures hop around in the mess, their wings like shrugging shoulders, their necks like little worms, yanking rubber-snap strings of meat off the skeletons with their beaks. The lionesses and the cubs have eaten their fill and are happily active now, tumbling around in the grass. The two males are massive as golden hills. They are brothers, twins, almost identical, except now the older one is missing an eye, recently lost while taking over the pride. The brothers, having killed two of the former alpha males and driven off the third, have further established their dominance by devouring all their rivals' cubs, four young females. But the swell and power of dominance they felt when they took over was a feeble feeling compared to the killing of the two human groups. A new feeling has overtaken the lions, a new understanding. One that changed their perception of humans from fellow predators, irritating, inconsequential animals to be ignored mostly, into prey. They saw them coming. Two of the smaller, swifter lionesses had climbed into a sausage tree above the tire trail and lay in wait. When the cars passed, the lionesses dropped in from above on the open metal boxes full of the pathetically weak mammals. Once those big, naked monkeys were on their slow, idiotic feet, it had been a quick rout. It wasn't because the lions were particularly hungry. The humans had been nothing compared to the 1,800-pound Cape buffalo, the pride's more typical prey. The cars had been like boxes full of snacks. The two males slip off the rock, first one, then the other. They amble through the pride, heads held high, ears perked up, mouths closed, tails swishing from side to side. After a moment, the females begin to follow, heads held low. As the two lions approach, a vulture standing on a woman's face shrugs its shoulders and takes flight, flapping, awkward and sloppy as a big pigeon. The one-eyed lion nudges the meat with his paw. He holds it down and takes a bite, his jaw making a popping sound as his carnassial teeth efficiently peel meat off the bone. After a moment's chewing, he looks up and turns his remaining eye to the east. His ears swivel, his nostrils dilate. His sense of hearing is only slightly above average, but the sebaceous glands around his chin, lips, cheeks, and whiskers give him a powerful sense of smell. He smells something. He glances at his brother, who is looking in the same direction now. Humans. The two convey to each other with a glance, a growl. More humans. The two males turn to the pride, changing their expressions and postures. They go through a repertoire of vocalizations, varying intensity and pitch, telling everyone what to do. Chapter 17. A chattering flock of storks burst from a treetop as we drove through a field some 3 miles or so north of the camp. They were marabou storks, distinguished by their wiry white hair, featherless pink necks, and tuxedo plumage, carrion eaters often found with vultures around carcasses. Undertaker birds, they're called. Abe grimaced up at them. He was projecting a cool facade, but I could tell he was worried, which made me worried. Actually, I had already been worried. Since we'd landed at the deserted camp, I'd found myself thinking about my first trip to Africa. It was a grad school field trip to the famous rock beds of the Karoo Desert region in South Africa, which showed one of the world's clearest geological snapshots of the history of life. What I kept thinking about was a layer of sediment from 250 million years ago that was completely empty of fossils. The lack of fossils in the rock was evidence of the Permian-Triassic extinction event, PTR in geology shorthand. PTR, or the Great Dying, was the biggest and baddest of Earth's major extinction events. 90% of all species on the planet rapidly perished. It took many millions of years for the Earth's biodiversity to recover. There have been 5 such major extinction events. Statistically, we're about due for one. The KT event, the one that killed the dinosaurs, was almost certainly caused by an asteroid impact. But we're still not sure about the PTR. Some theorize that the PTR extinction was caused by volcanic activity, or maybe an asteroid, or cosmic radiation. But no one really knows exactly why almost all the animals, vegetation, and insects in the world suddenly died. It was the mysterious nature of that ancient, total global ecosystem collapse that made the present HAC activity so unsettling. An animal's behavior is the result of millions of years of evolution, thousands upon thousands of generations of adaptation. This evolution happens in response to changes in the environment. The environment changes, and some animals adapt to it, some don't. To suddenly observe such anomalous behavior in wildly different species of animals all over the world wasn't just alarming. It was unprecedented. I opened my camera case and began to ready my video camera. I clipped in the battery, polished the lens, strapped on the shoulder mount. As we rolled deeper into the Okavango Delta in search of the missing tourists, I was suspecting more strongly that some kind of macro-level environmental disturbance was underway. I clacked in a new mini DV tape and was switching on my pricey-ass Sony image stabilizer when there was a commotion behind me. Abe's 2 Rhodesian Ridgebacks started barking like hell. Then, in an instant, my camera was no longer in my hands, and something hard and cold was pressed against my throat and collarbone. One of the men in the back was holding something against my neck, which I guessed was a machete, as that was what the other man had against Abe's neck. Abe brought the truck to a careful stop and looked up at the man holding the machete to his throat. He was speaking in Setswana. Abe's negotiation skills seemed to be all that stood between me and a severed jugular. My heart was going like a jackhammer. I could feel every hair on my arm standing straight up. The man holding the machete to Abe's throat kept shaking his head and gesturing back in the direction behind us. Abe kept talking. The man shook his head.
"No, no, 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 no," he said. "No, man."
The man lowered the machete in order to hop out of the car. He held the machete pointed at Abe, but was only half paying attention as he worked with the other hand to liberate the Winchester from the gun rack. Abe reached into the inner lining of his utility jacket, and his hand came out holding a nasty little snub-nosed 38 special. Abe put the pistol barrel between the man's eyes. They crossed, just as curlies do when Mo pokes him in the nose. The man took his hands off the rifle and lowered the machete. Then the guy behind me removed the machete from my neck.
The men and the teenager exchanged glances, shrugged as though they'd just lost a bet fair and square, and hopped out of the truck. Without another word to us, they started walking away, back in the direction we'd come from. The dogs growled and barked after them, but Abe whistled them silent. Abe was red-faced and shaking. At first I thought it was from fear, and then I realized it was mostly anger.
"Cowards!" Abe yelled back at them between his cupped hands. "Boogie shite-asses! Scoundrels!"
He spat brown juice out the window, wiped his face on his sleeve, cursed under his breath, and released the clutch.
"Superstitious, traitorous, idiot boogie sons of bitches,"
he muttered, half to me and half to himself, maybe half to the dogs.
"It's just us now, gents."
I leaned back in my seat and wiped sweat off my face as I closed my eyes. My pulse was still hammering when I turned and lifted the camera off the seat behind me. Maybe Natalie had been right about my coming here to Africa, I thought. A cubicle in an air-conditioned office building wasn't looking quite so terrible to me right about now. Chapter 18. A couple of miles farther north, we came up on some salt flats forked by a river delta. The scenery beyond them was breathtaking. An endless patchwork of more grassland and salt flats ran as far as the eye could see. I could understand why rich European and American tourists came to the Okavango Delta for safaris. The landscape was spectacular. The trail we'd been following passed through a ford in one of the river deltas.
"Jesus, are you sure?"
was all I could get out before Abe impassively stomped the accelerator and plowed us headlong into swirling water the color of chocolate milk. The water came up to the truck's door handles. I was expecting the motor to quit at any moment. I mentally prepared myself to go swimming. We got wet.
"You New Yorkers,"
Abe said, pushing us through the flood with his hand on the clutch and his foot on the gas, getting us through it with a mix of horsepower and will. He jerked his hat brim at the snorkel on the side of the truck.
"Got it handled, men. Leave it to Beaver."
We slogged through to the other side and up the steep, muddy bank onto a plain of tall, light green grass, maybe about 3 or 4 acres wide. A path of tire tracks cut straight across it toward a lagoon that sparkled like silver, where a herd of 70 or so Cape buffalo were shouldering each other in the shallows.
"Look sharp," Abe said, pointing to the herd. "We're getting close now. Those are the buffalo the lions hunt."
I almost dropped the video camera when Abe stomped the brake and brought us to an abrupt stop halfway to the lagoon. At the other end of the tall glade of faded grass, an open Land Rover exactly like ours, with the name of the safari company on the side, was parked by a sausage tree. Abe took a pair of binoculars from one of his kit bags and stood up on his seat. He slowly swept the glasses over the grassy plain. Then he lowered the binoculars, draped the strap over his neck, sat back down, and drove cautiously across the clearing toward the empty truck. We stopped beside the vehicle and got out. Something shiny caught Abe's eye. He bent down to the ground and lifted something from the grass. I zoomed in on it with the camera. It was a woman's gold Cartier tank watch. It looked as out of place here in the African veld as a shrunken head would have on a plate at the Four Seasons. The alligator strap was encrusted with blood. We got back in the truck and kept bucking and rocking over the grass. We weren't talking. There were clothes littering the ground around the empty truck and the trunk of the sausage tree, scattering among the grass and dwarf savanna shrubs. Blood-stiffened scraps of shirts, pants, a woman's sneaker, a fanny pack. Bits of fabric blew across the fields. There was a piece of what looked like a Hawaiian shirt stuck in the tree, fluttering on a branch like a flag. Abe looked up into the canopy of trees and then over at the Land Rover.
"Look, men," he said, pointing. "See the rifle? It's not even out of the rack. The safari guides who go out with the guests, they are no superstitious pussies like our dear cookie friends back there. They're professionals. This all must have happened in seconds. Too fast for them to get their guns."
"Male lions will protect their pride from humans, but this looks like some sort of ambush," I offered, trying to be helpful.
"And what did they do with the bodies?" Abe said. "Lions usually feed where they kill. I have never seen anything like this."
Chapter 19. stretched flat in the tall grass, the dominant one-eyed male lion crouches, waiting. Since hearing the distant grumble of the engine, he has been lying on the edge of the clearing about 80 feet to the east, just within charging range. His powerful chest rises and falls under his almost strawberry-blonde mane. His dusky amber eyes narrow, focused on the distance. He opens his mouth slightly, whiskers tingling as he scents the dry wind. Having hunted this pride area almost from birth, the 10-year-old male knows every inch of the terrain. At first, he'd lain in wait to the west, but he moved when the wind shifted. A keen predator, he takes up a position downwind, so his scent won't be detected by his prey. He is waiting patiently for his prey to put its head down or face the other way, the optimum position for attack. Just a moment or two of distraction will give him enough time to charge. He will finish the stalk as he always does, by quickly knocking his prey off its feet and clamping his jaws on its throat. He would have already attacked, except he is wary of people, unused to hunting them. He has been shot at several times before by hunters and game preserve rangers during his nomadic days of wandering before he had joined his pride. Without taking his eyes off the prey, the lion makes a low vocalization. It is answered by a soft growl, almost a purr, in the grass to his right, and then by another string of moans in the grass to his left. In response to his call for a stalking attack, the 2 dozen lions at his back split into 2 groups, one to flank and herd, the other to wait in ambush. The flanking lions begin skulking quickly, silently through the grass, using every scrap of cover. Their yellow and brown fur makes them all but invisible, tawny masses of grass-colored animals in the vegetation. They string themselves into a loose net around both the sausage tree and the prey, cutting off any chance of escape.
Chapter 20. Abe cocked his head and whistled, and the dogs leaped from the truck and into the tall grass.
"Listen, men," Abe said as he sighted through his rifle's telescope. "If it comes up, the best way to kill a lion is a headshot, right between the eyes."
"Thanks for the tip," I said, continuing to film. I lowered the camera a moment later when 2 sharp, loud dog whines rose in the air at the clearing's edge, one right after the other. Abe whistled for the dogs. Nothing happened. He put his fingers to his lips, whistled louder. Silence.
"That's not good," he said.
Abe raised the Remington to his shoulder and pressed an eye to its sight. I swung my camera in the same direction and held my breath. A lion appeared in the grass 20 yards to our east. I had never seen a lion in the wild before. It is a beautiful and terrifying sight. The sheer bigness of the animal. It truly makes something spin in your soul, deep below the ribs. I was still in a state of unprofessional awe when Abe pulled the trigger. The blast of the rifle so close to me was like a kick in the head. It left a mosquito whine in my left ear. In the place where the lion had been standing a moment before, there was nothing. It was as if he had disappeared. Abe climbed back up into the Land Rover.
"Get your ass up here if you feel like staying alive, men."
That sounded like a good idea to me. I slammed the door, and then there was motion from the other end of the clearing. A 2nd male lion broke cover and stood up in the tall grass, stalked still, tail swishing, watching us. There was something otherworldly and bleak about his implacable, amber-eyed gaze. The lion roared and began moving toward us, slowly at first. Then something triggered in him, and he tumbled into a charge, coming at us at breakneck speed. Abe pulled the trigger just as it began its leap. Another jolting crack of firepower in the air. I saw a fistful of brain fly out the back of his head. He died in the air and slammed onto the ground in a tumble, rolling into the driver's side of the truck, rocking it as though it were a cradle in the grass. I kept filming as Abe kicked out the bullet casing. It pinged off the edge of the windshield with a sound like a wind chime. On the ground below, I noticed that the lion was still breathing. Not for long. There was another whamming thud as Abe shot it right above the buttocks through the spine. Abe took out the rifle's magazine and replaced the two spent bullets. When he was done, he lifted off his hat and swiped his brow as he looked around the clearing. Silence. No insects. No birds. The shadow of a high white cloud raced over us. I took my eye from the viewfinder for a moment and looked at Abe beside me. He looked sick. I panned the camera, following his gaze. In the grass, about 30 feet away, surrounding the truck, was a circle of tawny heads. All the lions had manes. They were males. 2 dozen male lions. Abe was blinking, a finger to his open lips. He was so puzzled that confusion got the better of terror. "Impossible," he whispered. "All males." It didn't make sense. Male lions just don't do that. A pride of lions consists of a dozen or so related female lions and one, sometimes two, at most 3 or 4 males, if it's an unusually large group. Adult males who aren't part of a pride will hunt alone. Never, absolutely never, in the wild do male lions congregate in large numbers. It just doesn't happen. Except it was happening. I kept rolling with the camera as the male lions began moving. They moved forward for a few steps, then stopped to allow the lion behind them to go forward. They seemed like trained soldiers, coordinated, choreographed, synchronized. I expected Abe to stomp on the gas and get us the hell out of there. Instead, his mouth pinched into a hard set. Almost in a single fluid motion, he raised the rifle to his shoulder, sighted, and fired. Off to the left, the head of the lion closest to the truck blew open, and the animal slumped into the grass. Abe was swinging his rifle around for the next one when the grass in front of the truck opened up and a golden blur streaked in front of the camera. A paw caught Abraham in the face, and there was a cracking sound as he flipped out over the driver's side door. Chapter 21. For a long, much too long moment, all I could do was sit there in the passenger seat of the truck as if my ass had been nailed to it. I was visited with the same sudden, gut-squeezing spike of fear I'd experienced when I first jumped out of a Black Hawk as an Army Ranger medic in the Battle of Fallujah. I'd stood there at the door like a dunce with his dick in his hand, unable to move. "Okay, here we go. Here we go. Okay now. Paralysis. Here we go." I even did the same thing I'd done that day as bullets sang past my confused, cotton-filled head. "Act, jackass," I mentally screamed at myself. "Do something." Abe's gun was lying cockeyed across the driver's seat next to me. I snatched it up and anchored the barrel on the driver's side door. The lion had Abe in his mouth and was dragging him backward through the grass by the collar of his shirt. The rifle kicked hard against my shoulder as I shot the lion in the head. I jumped out of the truck and ran the 15 feet or so across the grass to where the dead lion lay and where Abe, his head pouring blood, was shakily climbing to his feet. My only goal at this point was to get us the hell out of there, get Abe to a doctor. I draped his arm around me and we hobbled back to the truck. Abe was bigger than me and much heavier. It was slow going. There was so much blood bursting from Abe's head I couldn't tell where the wounds were. I got him into the back seat of the truck and I was trying to MacGyver a bandage out of his shirt when the truck rocked like a boat and almost tipped over. A lion had leaped onto the hood like a cat scrambling onto an armchair. He peered curiously through the windshield. His eyes were warm amber stones. They glowed like heat, blood, and honey. I decided, if you want to call it that, the best place to be was under the steering wheel. I crawled into the front of the truck, toward the lion instead of away from it, a bit like a boxer leaning into a punch. I dropped under the steering wheel and squeezed myself in until I was crouching against the floorboard and clutching the gun. As I was waiting for my life to end, I reflected on the fact that the Rover was still running. I slammed my palm down on the gas pedal. The engine roared in place and nothing happened. It wasn't in gear. I pounded the clutch with my elbow and reached up and toggled the stick shift back and forth until I heard something catch. I let off the clutch and gave it some more gas with my other hand. The truck lurched backward. I'd managed to put it in reverse, which was fine with me. We were moving. I pressed the accelerator onto the muddy floorboard with my palm and held it there, and I felt the driverless truck rocking and fishtailing at random across the grass. My head whacked against the steering wheel and the metal doorframe as the Rover went bumping backward over the field. On the hood above me, I could hear the lion snarling, his claws clicked and shrieked against the glass. With the car still in motion, I unwound a little from the fetal position to see his front paws and his massive, shaggy head peeking over the top of the windshield. He looked like one of those old Kilroy was here drawings, and I reached up and cut the wheel hard to the left. The lion roared as he slid, scrabbling for purchase, off the windshield and fell beside the car, yelping as the Rover thumped against him. And then we were flying. The Rover went airborne, backward off the steep riverbank, and for a moment, we were in the air. While bracing for impact, I had a good long 2 seconds of quiet time to reflect on the situation my life was in. And in those seconds, I decided that I really couldn't blame Natalie for dumping my ass. Then we hit the ground. Chapter 22. Abe and I both went sailing out of the Rover as it smashed backward into the riverbank a good 10 feet below the sandy ridge. My body whumped into the muddy shore, and the truck beside me tipped onto its side with a groan and a decisive crunch of metal, plastic, and glass. I staggered to my feet, slapped mud from my face, and checked myself for injuries. I could feel bruises galore blooming all over my body, but nothing worse. The truck was still running, its engine panting, its back end submerged in muddy water. One sideways back wheel spun uselessly in the silt, stirring the muddy water. Abe was in bad shape, as in probably dead. One of his legs was pinned beneath the sideways Rover, and his head was all wrong, almost perpendicular to his body. It looked like his neck had broken in the crash. He wasn't breathing. I checked his pulse and wasn't surprised to find that he had none. Then, I glanced up at the edge of the riverbank shelf we'd just been flung from. The heads of lions peered over it. A moment later, they were spilling over its edge. I backpedaled into the shallows of the river. There was one lion in particular, huge, bigger than the others, with a reddish mane and one eye. This one had it in for me. He came right for me. I turned and dove deep into the river. Kicking as hard as I could, I swam as far out into the slow-moving muddy current as possible. This was a river in a time of drought. The water wasn't cold, and it wasn't deep. It was warm, shallow, and dirty. I stood on my tiptoes in the middle of the river, and the water line was just below my head. I shook my hair, blinked water out of my eyes, spat, watched the shore. Abe's body was surrounded by 6 or 7 lions, their manes rustling against each other. They pawed and picked at him as less majestic animals would do. But the other one, the big lion, strode past the sideways Rover and dove into the water after me, panting like mad as he paddled in my direction. I thought I was safe, but no. Lions hate water. They're not good swimmers. Their dense, muscular bodies aren't built for it. They'll swim, if necessary, to ford a river during the rainy season, for instance, but for a lion to chase prey into water is pretty much unheard of. I turned again and headed toward a sandy spit of land in the middle of the river. 10 paces from the shore of the islet, I saw a long black box bobbing in the water, drifting like a chunk of wood in the lazy current. Flotsam from the overturned Rover upstream. I splashed toward it, thinking I could maybe use it as a makeshift life preserver. It was a life preserver, in fact, one of the gun cases Abe had brought. I snatched it from the water and slogged for the shore. Stumbling, hurt, tired, with the gun case under my arm, I fought my way toward the reedy islet and felt the embankment rise under my heavy feet. I had no plan. I was beyond thinking. Ashore, I fell to my knees in the sucking reedy mud like a sinner in church, popped the clasps, thwack, thwack, and retrieved a flat black bolt-action Mauser 98, a truly badass.